really washed out day today. So since I wasn't going to get anything else to choose, I decided to translate Baudelaire. As you do. I found this poem called Omnisez-vous. Since we don't have the time, I won't read it in French. But I didn't like the English translation, so I'm trying the normal English translation. Enivrez-vous is always translated as get drunk. But to get drunk is to se saouler, which is kind of a loss of control. I didn't like it. So anyway, this is my first attempt. I might read other attempts at other Baudelaire nights. Get high. I moved a couple of words around, but not much. Get high. One must always be high. All there is. It's the only question to not feel the horrible burden of time that breaks your shoulders and bends you towards the dirt. You must get high. Inebriated, intoxicated, incessantly. But on what? On wine, on poetry, or virtue, as you wish, whatever you have in yourself. As long as you get high, inebriated, intoxicated, and if sometimes on the steps of a palace or the grass of a ditch or in the mournful loneliness of your room you should awaken, your drunkenness diminished or disappeared, ask the wind, the wave, the star, the bird, the clock. Ask all that flies, all that whimpers, all that rolls, all that sings, all that talks. Ask, what hour is it now? And the wind, the wave, the star, the bird, the clock will all answer. Now is the hour to get high. So as not to be martyred slaves of time, get high. Get high, inebriated, intoxicated incessantly on wine, on poetry, or even virtue, if you wish, whatever you have in yourself.
And next we have Stanley Knox.
Thank you. I just wanted to start by saying I'm not wearing the t-shirt for last week. I did change the
You washed it.
I did. I washed it twice, actually. But it's one of those things that I have a t-shirt about a year, and it's probably the t-shirt I have that's been most commented on when I wear it.
Yeah.
And when you do your own t-shirt, which I do a lot, that's quite nice. And there is a backstory. I did a creative writing course about a year ago, and on the first night, there was kind of thing where people said what they wanted to get from the course. And there was a girl on it called Eileen, lovely, lovely woman. And she said, as part of her goal, saying, I'd like to maybe write a poem during the course. So I said, well, oh, we'll get that over you for definitely. And she said to me, who are you, the poetry dentist? So I got the t-shirt on and I wrote this little piece. No, the L badge was added to the t-shirt much later, but when I finish this, you might understand what the L badge actually stands for. So it's called the poetry dentist, and it's after Eileen. My occupation, I think, is strange. Others say worse. They think I'm deranged. But I can't help what I enjoy, and my occupation is my favourite toy. So I prod and I poke, see it's never too late. I probe and I pull, then excavate, looking for words, phrases and rhymes, interesting images or wonderful lines. See, I know they're waiting deep in your soul. I know they're waiting, waiting to be known. And I know you want to set them free. It's there in your face. For everyone to see. And yet, very often, my advance you resist. I'm not ready yet, you indignantly insist. But I'm not giving in, no, I will persist. Because if I don't, we both lose a wish. A wish that hidden glories be allowed to unfold, for beautiful stories finally to be told. So come take my hand, let me lead you through the mist. Come sit for a while with the poetry dentist.
Next we have Sue Cosgrove.
I was reading a book called The Ancient Victorian Holocaust some years ago, and it was about the famines that swept across the empire in Queen Victoria's time, and the Irish famine was one of them, of course. And it so happened that I was reading at the anniversary of the bombing in London that year. So this poem is called A Recipe for Mangalapatari Soup. As you know, that's an Indian soup created by the British. Living in a state of moral outrage. Chop, 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 tomato in the pot. Living amoral in a state of outrage. Chop, chop, add some carrots to the pot. Stately living, no morals, and not a shred of outrage. Chop, two halves of onion in the pot. Into the brew, add a dash of salty liquid. Put with measure too. Chop, half a pointy index finger, done. A generous slash of blood, little. Sprinkle pepper, red hot spice, a calloused handful of dead bits with mounty rice. Let it thicken, let it brew, simmer gently, stir it too. Let it stew a century or two. Watch it sizzle, see it splutter. Watch it bubble, see it boil. Watch it spill above the rim. And then, when ready, garnish with slivers of old bone, a child's bent femur is crunchiest of all. Serve it in bowls rimmed in 20-karat gold. You who cooked it, eat it hot. I who waited, simmered rage. Less one jabbing index finger shall eat it too in a dish served cold.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, next we have Seamus Harrington. The dentist, who came to Coot Hill, relying on his flat windowsill, with handfuls of old, he extracted gold, then purchased a new matting drill. The Viking. She'd have no truck with mock tall ships, bulimic tanks of liquid gold. I don't propose to bend a knee, and never would unstep the mast to suit that bridge that hems us in to harbour years of gangway life. We'll stay secured and keep each guest their posh hotel, my tumble home. My figurehead will often cast a jaundiced eye on Lego ships, with cargoes boxed in vivid stacks, bad-mannered ribs and soap dish boats that skim across our basin berth, and towering hulks decked out in glass where bubbling pools of idle rich old landsmen soak their golden hinds. Her secret wish has always been return again to naval days. The trill and ring of ordered steps, a manifest of fresh cadets to line the yards, parade of sail, those forecastle airs of every ilk, our master's voice across the poop and gimbaled hours away offshore. The soundless mitt, a bosun's pet, his musing gaze as flying fish play and break about my lee cat head. In distant roads, the windless song, transcendent moon for ebb and flow. We'd love to seek a further voyage, secluded shores I've yet to trace, like sights within the piper's song. And yes, I miss this canvas crest. Feel foot ropes dance where topmen tread, at harbour's mouth a lash of salt, to rinse my plunging crimson line, a creaking sheen. The quiet routine, ice broken clear and furrowed drills, the sighing wind at each crow's nest, a field of wheat discharged at last.
Thank you, Shane. And let's hear Marie coming.
He really gives an artist's retreat in Kerry. At night from my attic window, the cow and calf islands gleam like silver under the waning moon. Below, sheep drift between the empty cottages. Boxes slink from the edges of dark fields. I light a circle of tea lights until the low ceiling flickers like a galaxy, then hold a couch bed under the glass roof of the studio. Watch stars backed up in the sky. I glimpse infinity. Then my eyes swim. The cliff above me looms. grows crescents and crescent horns. A goat stands, sniffing the air, its head in the stars.
Thanks, Billy.
I'm going to read a very short story about Kafka. It's only 22 paragraphs, so don't start freaking out. It's called Poseidon, about the god of the sea. Poseidon sat at his desk going over the accounts. The administration of all the waters gave him endless work. He could have had as many assistants as he wanted, and indeed he had quite a number. But since he took his job very seriously, he insisted on going through all the accounts again himself. And so his assistants were a bit left to him. It cannot be said that he enjoyed the work. He carried out simply because of the same to him. Indeed, he had frequently applied for what he called more cheerful work. But whenever various suggestions were put to him, it turned out that nothing suited him quite so well as his present employment. Needless to say, it was very difficult to find him another job. After all, he could not possibly be put in charge of any one particular ocean. Quite apart from the fact that in this case the work involved would not be less, only more petty, the great Poseidon could only hold a superior possession. And when he was offered a post unrelated to the waters, the very idea made him feel sick. His divine breath came short and his brazen chest began to heave. As a matter of fact, no one took his troubles very seriously. When a mighty man complained, one must pretend to yield, however hopeless the case may seem. No one ever really considered relieving Poseidon of his position. He had been destined to be god of the sea since time immemorial, and that was how it had to remain. What annoyed him most, and this was the chief cause of his discontent with his job, was to learn of the rumours that were circulating about him. For instance, that he was constantly cruising through the waves with his trident, instead of which here he was, sitting in the depths of the world's ocean, endlessly going over the accounts. An occasional journey to Jupiter being the only interruption of the monotony. A journey, moreover, from which he returned invariably returning in a furious temper. As a result, he had hardly seen the oceans, save fleetingly during his hasty ascent to Olympus, and had never really sailed upon them. He used to say that he was postponing this until the end of the world, for then there might come a quiet moment when, just before the end, and having gone through the last account, he could still make a quick little tour.
Thank you. Next we have our Firebird Challenge winner, Neve Pryor.
This is based on the nursery rhyme Pop Goes the Weasel. It's called Surrogate. 4 years, two boys, set twins. I've had for other people. That's the way the money comes. Pop, it's that simple. $26,000 ago, I charge for little people. Beat all the day jobs I know. Pop, it's that simple. I've delivered goods for Asians, a nice gay Irish couple, an American Caucasian. Pop, it's that simple. You can shove your moral discourse in. I'm just using my ample. Blessed natural resources. Pop, it's that simple.
Thank you. Next we have Patricia Walsh.
Thank you, Grant. This poem was about my father and my relationship with him. He died about 2 years ago, and I wanted to speak ill of the dead, but he wasn't easy with people to get on with. This is called Dad's Cabinet. Fingers in the pulse without a crest. I'm still alive, so here we see this tableau of tea time. Starting the afternoon into those simultaneous equations of flesh and genes, reduce the hankering error in empathies, which in a day would never have existed. What we see is the harbouring of comedies, restricting our exports back and forth for reasons we don't want to understand. Okay.
Thank you, Patricia. Next we have Michael Ray.
Thrush. In the exuberance of first flight, you found my window difficult to navigate. in a moment, his air has invisible walls. I found you dazed below the sill, put you in a box where, head under wing, you perched until morning. On seeing your mother speaking, I opened the door, watched as you hopped towards her, a joyous flutter across the snow. But the black and white rush and throttle of the magpie snipped in a second at the turtle bond.
Thank you, Michael. Next we have Mihorosh.
This one is, there's a song I thought years ago, but it's in an ad now again. It's that one by Run DMC, Jam Master Jay, I don't know, it's like that.
Oh, yeah.
You know that one?
Yeah.
That someone was in there. But it's in an ad at the minute. I think it's Fantad or Kilbarn, but I couldn't sleep till night. And it came on, and the first line is when I'm playing into the repartee. And I think I said, fuck it. I think it fixed the state of the country. Like, so I just messed around with two of the verses that I knew in my head. So this reason why I'm not going to sing it because
I do.
No, not that I might even start off, you know. Unemployment at a record high, people going, people leaving, the remainder want to die. No need to ask me because we all know why. It's those greedy bankers who continue to lie. One thing I know is that life is short, so listen up, fat cats, give this a thought. Just because you're not in prison doesn't mean you haven't been caught. For God will have his day and heaven can't be bought.
Alright,
next up is Kieran and Marshall. This is called The Striking of a Match, and it's for King. Would you like to strike a match, my lady? For nothing encapsulates the brevity of it all like the striking of a match. The meeting of two idle objects, cardboard with its flint coat on, and the stick with potential at its tip, they catch. And just for a moment, an explosion of colour and sound. Nothing of note apparent, but together quite profound. The brevity of what, you say? The brevity of who? Well, the brevity of me, my dear, and the brevity of you. For how brief is potential's visit to the soul. How brief the youth before they call it old. I thought I'd have more time, the opportunist said. I thought there'd be another chance to voice these wonders in my head. But now the day is bitter, and how the time is sped. Consumed by potential, and now my chance is dead. How it came to me the other day, of you with nothing in my way. Just for a moment did it stay, but touched my mind like a sun's ray. As your face brightens my entire day, and I am happy in your presence. In that presence, may I say, would you find it pleasant? Would you come with me to the autumn diner, the midnight cafe, the moonlit street? Some say certainty would be finer, but in certainty, what do you meet? In certainty comes in no wonder, no potential, no hope, no chance. It's the uncertainty and the hunger that makes me ask for this dance. For who knows if it is real, the wonder that I feel. For these opportunities to hatch, would you like to strike a match?
Right, next we have Africa Witch.
I didn't personally drop the title of a Yeats poem. And then I just actually read it thinking about it. Okay, it's called No Need. No need to tell me that endings are moments of transcendence, and all that is solid melts into air. No need to tell me of the passing of things. I know the idling tales of life, of furniture and fridge snacks that stack up, then vanish in a flame lick. No need to challenge me to walk the high wire or to drag me to a party with all the wrong people, where men take up space with knuckles on hips and madness there in the elderly. No need to tell me I'm in safe hands. I've seen your scar and know what you're made of. No need for you to hold up a cardboard cutout of the sun. I remember how it looks, how it feels. Or to tell me that I'm more stone than heart. What do you expect? I'm half a couple from arc days, pickling memories in a jar. No need to tell me that love will return someday, like speech after long silence. That's Jesse Johnson.
I guess that's Atomic Mass.
Woo!
Whoa. Hey.
Very depressed time in Ireland, but in actual fact there was an awful lot of energy and everybody was forming committees and community groups and stuff like that and trying to get stuff done, so there's a lot of energy around the place. They called Ned Ryan. Ned Ryan, a russet-faced man, had called the meeting and he was in his element. His portly figure paced back and forth at the top of the hall as it began to fill with people and cigarette smoke. In his opening address, Ned proposed a week-long festival, the culmination of which would be the unveiling of a monument to the Gunner McGee, a dead patriot from the 1798 rebellion who happened to be buried in the graveyard adjacent to Ned's pub. Most of the initial statements were of approval and there were questions regarding logistics of running such an event, but rather than get bogged down in minutiae, Ned diplomatically deflected these questions by saying that the new committee would look after those issues. As he looked to the floor for nominations for the committee, Prunches McAnumra, the principal of the local national school, got up to speak. There was a purposeful shuffle of feet and a sound like a dog yawning came from the back of the hall. As he rose, he loosened his tie and the townspeople braced themselves. They knew his form. A few years previous, he had run for local election and while he was by far the best man for the job, failed to get elected. His incessant campaigning was based on getting real jobs and to stop what he called the hemorrhaging of our youth. By polling day, even his friends failed to vote for him because they felt they wouldn't be able to stick him if elected. During the campaign, Ned Ryan was noted to have said that Prunches wasn't concerned about the youth until the condom came on the scene, and there would be real possibility in the future of his three-teacher school becoming a two-teacher school. Of course, Prunches heard about this and never darkened Ned's door since. Prunches opened his speech with a couple of words in Irish. He seemed to resent having to speak English at all, but in order to get his point across, he would do so. Why, he asked, would we wish to commemorate the Gunner McGee, and was not the right of the townspeople to decide who they should commemorate? If the Gunner had his way, Prunches said, we'd all be speaking French and eating frogs' legs. And furthermore, he said, the Gunner was no more a hero, but died from the intake of too much alcohol. But that little fact, he said, wouldn't upset Ned Ryan, who had his pub full of his students every Saturday night. Before sitting down, he put forward the name of a dead Republican of little consequence and said it should be put to a vote. Niamh Marr, the new French teacher to the school, took offence at Prunches' slight on the French people and their language and reminded him that it was the 80s, the 1980s, that is, she said with emphasis. This got a laugh and hoops from the back of the hall. She went on to suggest that the festival could be held in conjunction with a twinning to a French town. And Prunches interrupted from a seated position to say that a twinning had no place in a festival of Irish culture, Ciol or Gazrinca. And Ned, in an effort to restore order, misjudged the situation by asking Mr. Croft, the draper, for his opinion, and hoping that his genteel manner would put the meeting back on track. Mr. Croft was small in stature, well proportioned and dapperly dressed. Mrs. Croft, of identical stature, was beside him, caught unawares brushing minute pieces of fluff off her navy skirt. Mrs. Croft ran a women's drapery section in their shop on the Diamond directly across from Ned's, and they were both highly thought of in the town. Mrs. Croft's discretion was highly valued by the older women of the town who shopped there. There was nothing by way of undergarments on display. Unlike the modern boutiques, everything was shelved in identical grey boxes with a simple label stating style and size, and a little outline sketch to show the shape of the garment. And when Mrs. Croft knew her customer had switched from box to brown paper wrapping could occur without a word being spoken concerning the said item. And these same women valued Mr. Croft as he relieved them of the burden of having to dress their husbands. And the husbands in turn valued his judgment in attiring them in a fashion which suited both their character and their pocket. Mr. Croft cleared his throat, and speaking for himself and Mrs. Croft, he always called her Mrs. Croft, he welcomed Eve to the town, and he said he thought the festival was a good idea, and the twinning was a good idea. He praised Ned Ryan's endeavours and wished him every success, and said he would support him in whatever way he could. Everybody in the hall knew this meant money, but he'd never darken the door of Ned's. As he concluded, a chair scraped the boards and was punches on his feet again. Angry that his proposal had been completely ignored, he said he shouldn't have expected anything more from the supers in the front row, referring to Mr. and Mrs. Croft. The hall hummed its disapproval at this comment. A shocked Mr. Croft rose and turned to face Mr. McInamara, and clutching the back of the chair, his voice wavering, demanded an apology, but felt the need to highlight his pedigree. Being one of the first families to have arrived at the plantation of Ulster, he said, the Crofts had settled on a drapery business in the town since and had never encountered such bad manners. Punches remained seated while he apologised and said he didn't realise Mr. Croft had come on Cromwell's coattails, and then mumbled something about Mr. Croft wanting to erect a monument to Cromwell himself. That was thought most unfair by nearly all present. Ned, who was perspiring heavily, attempted to restore calm by referring to Michelle Darcy, who was in the middle of the hall. Ned had a lot of time for Michelle, who had opened a new barber shop in the town, partly because she reminded him of his own daughter who was in the States, but also he liked her directness and enjoyed watching her put some of his regulars in their place. Michelle was tall with a bleached blonde cropped haircut and stood with one hand in the back pocket of her tight Levi's and spoke of diversity and inclusiveness and proposed a monument to depict this. Miss Cassidy, the librarian, with her hair pinned down, stood up and asked Miss Darcy, or was it Ms., she hissed, what exactly did she mean by diversity and could she explain it to the rest of us? From the back of the hall, an angry Mrs. Cummins shouted out, extramarital affairs, I suppose. And when she realised everybody was looking at her and expected more, she shouted, divorces, and penetrated Miss Darcy with a look. There were guffaws and chair shuffles around the hall, but nobody could make any sense of what she said except Ned, who at this point didn't know who to call on and was dapping his forehead with a handkerchief. He had received a phone call during the week from Mrs. Cummins telling him to send her husband home for dinner, that she didn't want him drinking with that whore. Ned knew there was no truth in the allegation and had never seen Michelle show interest in any man on his premises. And as far as he could make out, there was never a man on the scene. She spent most of her time in the pub with Neve, or they'd buy a takeout and go back to her flat. Sometimes they'd be in the company of Antonio Gilmartin, chip shop owner, known affectionately as the Burger Queen, and liked it. Ned couldn't work that one out at all. What good in the name of God could he be to anyone? Michelle sat down in the awkwardness as the volume of laughter, chatter and smoke in the hall rose, and Ned, wiping his neck, searched for faces that he felt could move the meeting on. As he loosened his tie, a call for quiet came from the back of the hall, and loud shushes were heard as people realised Dr. Dolan wanted to speak. Ned was relieved, but felt he needed to sit while the doctor spoke. Dr. Dolan realised the possible failure of the meeting, cut to the heart of the matter and nominated himself as secretary, and looked to be seconded and requested the other post to be filled straight away. Ned, his face a full ruddy colour now, began to feel that at last the meeting may be fruitful, and proceeded to address the meeting. At this point, Punches McInamara got up to leave, and others saw it as an opportune moment to do likewise, slinking out, half crouching, half running, like leaving Mass after communion. Miss Cassidy said to whoever would listen that she wouldn't sit on any committee with that man, referring to the doctor as he made an indecent request of her when examining her arthritic knee. This obviously couldn't be verified, but making such an allegation did seem out of character with Miss Cassidy. At this point, Ned's legs buckled beneath him, and he collapsed, clutching his chest. Mr. and Mrs. Croft ran to his assistance, and Dr. Dolan ran up from the end of the hall. The doctor sent for an ambulance, but Ned was dead on arrival at Sligo General. Someone said he just gave a little squeak out of him as he dropped to the floor. Many locals believed that it was the ambulance was the doing of Ned. Wasn't he alive when he went into it?